I'm Tony Cox. This is Tell Me More from NPR News. Michelle Martin is away. Some legislators in Illinois say it's time to call out the National Guard to quell the summer violence in Chicago. Three police officers have died, and the total homicide count, 273 so far this year, is well beyond that of other major American cities. We'll talk about that in a moment. We'll go to Mexico as well on the program, looking deeper into the almost unbelievable violence there resulting from the almost unbelievably lucrative drug trade. And later, a trip down the mighty Congo River. You'll want to hear behind-the-scenes stories of NPR's Ophelia Quist Arctin's latest series. But first, the violence in Chicago, again at alarming levels.
Chicago police have been dealing with an outbreak of deadly shootings on the city's west side that have claimed five lives, including a 15-year-old
boy. Two children are shot and injured riding home with their parents after a visit to grandma's house.
A despondent mom is overcome with grief at the site where her 18-year-old son took his last breath.
Police execute a search warrant and are shot. Tonight, two suspected gunmen still in custody with charges coming.
Last month, an 8-year-old girl was killed when she was caught in the middle of gunfire. Just yesterday, two officers were wounded on the city's south side, and five were killed, and at least 18 others were wounded in a rash of shootings this past weekend. Joining us now to talk about the issues behind Chicago's gang violence, we have John Hagedorn, a professor of criminal justice at the University of Chicago, of the University of Illinois at Chicago. Also with us here in studio with us in Washington, Ron Hampton, retired police officer and executive director of the National Black Police Association. And we are also joined by Sudhir Venkatesh, professor of sociology at Columbia University and the author of Off the Books, The Underground Economy of the Urban Poor and Gang Leader for Day. Gentlemen, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Let me begin by setting it up this way. There was a controversial meeting in Chicago on Sunday involving the superintendent of police, the FBI, and a number of so-called gang leaders. And as a result of that meeting, there were, according to press accounts, threats made against those individuals who attended that meeting by law enforcement to say that if you don't do something about this, we will take it out on you personally. As a law enforcement person, Ron Hampton, is a meeting like that of value, or does it cause more problems than it solves?
It causes more problems than it solves.
And why is that?
Because if you want to get to the bottom of the problems that are going on in the community, then you need to bring all the parties together, all of the stakeholders together, and then talk about how you solve the problem. You need to talk about what the problems are, and then you need to agree upon a strategy after you've talked about that in terms of how we're going to address it. But if you don't address those systemic social issues, some of the things that some of my colleagues on the line will probably talk about, then we're not going to get to that. But one of the main things you got to address is that relationship between the police and the community. And that's not getting off on the right foot.
John Hagedorn, I'm going to ask you to give your response to that. But first, let's play a clip from the superintendent, Jody Weiss, about that meeting that took place on Sunday.
We brought in some of the leaders and just told them that they would be responsible for any activity by their group. The activity we're referring to is violence. And we told them if someone is killed, we will use every resource we have to target the entire group.
Professor Hagedorn, what about that? You heard the opinion of Ron Hampton, a retired police officer. I believe your point of view is different.
Well, I agree of what the nature of a meeting should be. It should be a discussion of all the causes. What the superintendent is doing is continuing a war on gangs that has started in 1969 by the old mayor, and this was another threat, and a threat to step up the warfare. They haven't solved the problem in 40 years and using warfare. Maybe they should start talking to people and one of those forces within the community to talk to, not to threaten, would be the gangs, of course.
Right. Now, there have been discussions of this kind, similar, in other jurisdictions around the country, and studies have shown, according to David Kennedy, the New York professor who was behind this 15-year study, that these kinds of meetings actually lead to a decrease in violent crime. Sudhir, what's your take on these kinds of interactions between law enforcement and the leaders of gangs at a time when there is an increase in gang violence?
Well, I'm actually in favor of what the superintendent is doing. I think it's a great effort. To try and reach out to these folks is imperative, and it actually happens every day. It happens every month in these communities. What they should probably be doing a little differently is to make sure that their community leader is present, and that's not happening. It's not the superintendent's responsibility. It's someone in that department at the local level who reaches out to clergy, to school principals and others, and that meets with these gang leader representatives and says, okay, these are our problems, these are our issues, this is what we need to move forward. That's a successful strategy that's proven in every urban context, and it should definitely be used in Chicago.
This is Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Tony Cox, speaking with John Hagedorn, a professor of criminal justice at the University of Illinois at Chicago, with Ron Hampton, executive director of the National Black Police Association, and with Sudhir Venkatesh, professor of sociology at Columbia University. We are talking about the violence in Chicago. Some of the research, Professor Hagedorn, that you have been involved with, as I understand it, suggests that housing patterns in a city, public housing patterns in a city like Chicago, have something to do with the level of violence that is being experienced there. Can you explain that?
Well, when you look at Chicago and New York, the homicide patterns have been the same since Prohibition. And then they changed in the 90s, and the New York's shot down to really low levels, and Chicago's did not. And the key difference is that Chicago dismantled their housing projects, scattering people in gangs all over the place, creating all sorts of hostility. And New York invested in housing. People stayed in their neighborhoods and their projects, and the things settled down.
Sudhir, you have some experience in this area as well, do you not?
Yes, we've been following about 1,000 families who left, as John was saying, these housing projects moved into other areas. And what happens is you get a flood of families moving into a community. It could be a middle-class community, a poor community. They don't know their neighbors. The neighbors may not trust them. The local gangs start to fight one another, and there's really nobody there to conduct the kind of mediation and the conflict resolution. And the other thing we should remember is a lot of the communities that are experiencing these kinds of problems didn't experience them 30 years ago. So they're down in the far south side of the city or the far west suburbs. They don't have churches that provide services. They don't have YMCAs. So we need a philanthropic attention. We need the city to understand that these places don't have the infrastructure for social services and to help the police do their work more effectively. So they're not wastelands philanthropically, but they don't have the support necessary for youth who are there.
What about this, Ron, exporting crime from public housing into other areas where it wasn't, and how do you police that?
Well, that has happened in an awful lot of our cities because we've had mayors who have wanted to break up and public housing areas that have traditionally just had public housing, and then we see mixed dwellings, you know, a variety of different things, moving poor families into those kind of neighborhoods. And those, the problems that the two professors talked about are a manifestation of that. But one of the things that I would say is that the Chicago Police Department missed an opportunity. If they're really doing community policing, and I know we talk about that an awful lot, probably too much, but the fact of the matter is if they was doing community policing, they would have had some of these components, non-governmental organizations, community-based organizations, been there in the meeting to talk about these issues, because the professor from Columbia is right. If you don't have those entities in there to talk about the different things that are going on so people can take ownership of their community, it also is reflective of no relationship, if any relationship that the community may have with the police department. And they've sort of been on this position for some time.
Well, let me ask you this then, Ron Hampton, because if that's the case in Chicago, mm-hmm. you can't bring public housing back. You know, you're not going to bring right. the Robert Taylor Homes and mm-hmm. Cabrini Green back, nor would you probably want to. So how do you handle, from a law enforcement point of view, the gang problem that exists there right now?
Well, you put police officers out there on the street who understand that the foundation of organizing a community is working with the groups that's in the community, working with the people that live there, working on those problems, doing problem solving, bringing in the different stakeholders, getting people to take ownership of their communities and neighborhoods, and therefore then they begin to address the problem. Because most police officers don't live in our community, so the people who live there have to grapple with those issues. But if they don't feel empowered to deal with them, and the police cannot empower them. I just don't believe that. But what they can do is work with them in a way of dealing with the issues and use the power of their office to do the kind of organizing around the resources that they need to get the job done.
Well, Sudhir, in the time that I have left, which is not very much, this sounds, from what Ron is talking about, it is as much a political solution as a law enforcement solution. Would you agree with that?
Absolutely. I tell you, in 20 years, I've met police officers who tell me one thing, and it's going to sound strange to the majority of Americans, but we have to remember these are poor, disenfranchised communities. They tell me that it's very, very difficult to prevent crime, but what I need to do when I'm in these communities is to make sure that the violence doesn't get out of control, and so they have to dampen it. But if they do that successfully, somebody has to come into their place, and that is a political question. Do we have the will and the resources to get there?
Well, certainly in Chicago, we have seen that there is not political agreement about that. The governor was in favor of these meetings that took place on Sunday. Some others are suggesting that that was not the thing to do, and in fact, just today, there was a news conference by some of the gang-affiliated people who weren't involved in the meeting on Sunday who were saying, look, this is what we do, you know, and don't expect us to change. And that meeting was a dirty trick, and you know it.
The superintendent has created a lot of problems for himself as well as for the city by going about it in the way that he has.
I appreciate the conversation, gentlemen. Our time has run out. Sudhir Venkatesh, professor of sociology at Columbia University, author of Off the Books, The Underground Economy of the Urban Poor and Gang Leader for a Day. Also, John Hagedorn, a professor of criminal justice at the University of Illinois at Chicago, joining us from Milwaukee. And here in studio with me in Washington, Ron Hampton, executive director of the National Black Police Association. Gentlemen, again, thank you all very much. Tony Coxon, this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Michelle Martin is away. Coming up, Mexico's drug trafficking wars have claimed tens of thousands of lives, and with the recent massacre of 72 migrants from south of Mexico's borders, the violence is far from over. We'll talk about the dangerous but intricately organized Mexican drug cartels. But first, to one of the largest countries in the world, the Democratic Republic of the Congo. It is the land of the mighty Congo River, which runs 3,000 miles and has fascinated explorers and kings alike. It has played a vital role, of course, in the lives of the Congolese. NPR's West Africa correspondent Ophabia Quist-Arkton took a long trip down the Congo River, providing rare insight into the relationship between the river and the people. She was joined on the trip by producer Jonathan Blakely, a first-timer to that part of the world. Both of them join us now, Ophabia from her office in Dakar, Senegal, and Jonathan from Baghdad, where he is on assignment. Hello to both of you.
Greetings.
Hi, Tony. Hi, Ophabia.
Hi.
We cannot wait to hear more about this fascinating and remarkable trip that you took down the Congo. But before we get to that, Ophabia, I wanted to spend a couple of moments on a very significant piece of news coming out of the region, which is related to Congo's troubled history of civil war and violence, and a UN report about reprisal killings after the 1994 genocide. What's the latest there?
Now, the report is about what happened in Congo, but it really reflects on the army of Rwanda next door. As you know, the genocide in 1994, mainly Tutsi, 800,000 Tutsis killed there, and moderate Hutus. Now, what this leaked UN report, it has not been formally published yet, but what it is saying is that 2 years after, 1996 to 1997, these same Rwandan forces that were fighting the genocide across the border crossed into eastern Congo and apparently killed tens of thousands of Rwandan Hutu refugees and Congolese Hutu. Now, Rwanda is saying this report is rubbish, it's scurrilous, and it is actually threatening to pull out its peacekeeping forces from all UN operations, and it is actually commanding the joint UN African Union peacekeeping force in Darfur, Sudan. So it's really very serious.
Is this saber-rattling by a Rwandan President Paul Kagame, or is he serious?
I think it's a bit of both. Up till now, really, Paul Kagame has had the lever on everyone because the international response to the genocide in Rwanda was so lackluster, in fact, virtually non-existent, he has had a lever on the United Nations, on Washington, which failed to respond under President Clinton, on Britain. In fact, all Western nations who Kagame blames for having done nothing during the genocide. Now his government, his foreign minister, Louise Mushikiwabo, is saying it's absolutely ludicrous and it's hypocritical and double standards of the UN to turn around and say that the same force that it allows to command its peacekeeping operations in Darfur is the force it is accusing of genocide, that the G word has been used, of atrocities in Congo, and that this is malicious.
We'll keep our eyes on that. Thank you very much, Fabio. So now let's move on to this trip that you made, this fabulous trip with producer Jonathan Blakely, an exploration of the beauty and the people along the Congo River. You traveled 500 miles down the river on a barge. Here's a moment when you boarded the vessel.
Suddenly, this boat that we're taking is just chock-a-block. When I last visited it, there were, what, maybe a couple of dozen people on board and some goats. Now it looks as if there are 300 plus people on board and the vessel has considerably sunk. I hope we're within legal limits for how many people are allowed on board. Ma Flo. Bonjour. Good morning, Flo. How are you?
Ah, merci beaucoup.
On est prêt à partir? Are we ready to leave?
Oui, nous sommes prêts à partir.
Finally.
I'm going to ask you about the boat in just a moment, but what makes the Congo River such a fascinating body of water?
Tony, let me first tell you that it ain't a boat. It was not a boat. It was a barge. Two 50-foot barges lashed together and pushed by a tugboat. Not a boat in the conventional sense of the word at all. But yeah, talking about the Congo River, it's quite something. It's massive. As you said, 3,000 odd miles. Most of it navigable, some of it not navigable. And it is the lifeline of the Congo. It runs through the heart of the country. It takes people into the interior, the remote hinterland, where, you know, we were passing villages that were literally made up of one or two mud huts, slightly bigger villages, towns, but they all relied on the river. As one Congolese balladeer sang, this river is our main boulevard. It is the artery of Congo.
Jonathan Blakely, let me bring you into the conversation. I'm curious to hear from you what your thoughts were when you first, A, saw the Congo River itself and all its majesty, and B, when you saw that barge that was going to be your home for a while.
Yeah, you look at that barge and you say, you mean that one right there, the one with all the people on it? I don't think there's any room for us. But we did figure out a way to get on that barge thanks to our guide and journalist and interpreter, Emery Makumeno. And he wheeled and dealed and got us onto that barge. But I'm just now getting to absorb how magnificent and what a wonderful and amazing journey I took with Ophabia. It was so overwhelming. There's so much coming at you, not just the people, but the beauty of that part of the world, a part of the world that, you know, most people never get to see with their own eyes. I got to see 500 miles of it on that river.
If you're just joining us, I'm Tony Cox, and you're listening to Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm speaking with NPR's West Africa correspondent, Ophabia Quist-Arkton, about Africa's third largest country, the Democratic Republic of the Congo, and her recent trip to the mighty Congo River, along with NPR producer Jonathan Blakely. Before I ask you the next question, Ophabia, about it, let's listen to another part of your report about some of the food on the barge.
I see a monkey.
Maybe the viande aussi, the sand.
Martha Kapanga is clutching a smoked monkey, considered a mouth-watering delicacy in many parts of Congo, while he points to a range of other live animals on board. Some are pets, others will end up in cooking pots. Kapanga has invited us to tuck into what he promises will be a delicious smoked monkey stew.
I don't know if you know this, Ophabia, or not, but there was quite a reaction to that part of your report on the NPR website, people talking about, you know, eating monkeys, and some had, well, positive things to say, and some had some more curious kinds of things to say. Tell us more about that experience.
Well, yes, we have to, you know, there's some things Americans eat that people in the rest of the world also look askance at. But I have to say that monkeys and other bushmeat, as they're called, are delicacies in the Democratic Republic of Congo, and the Congolese enjoy it. It's true that in the West there's much more education about conservation, about animals, but we're not talking about the great apes here. We're not talking about our brothers and sisters, the baboons and so on. We're talking about monkey meat, and they do eat it. And what's more, they eat it and enjoy it. So I think some people have been a bit offended. They felt that perhaps I should have said to the Congolese, no, you should think about conservation. But people are surviving in Congo. You know, they don't sometimes have the option, and they don't have the sort of money and in the West to decide whether or not and what they're going to eat. Fresh fish from the Congo River was what they mostly ate, but they also brought smoked fish, salted fish, and smoked monkey because they could preserve that and eat it on the way. I wasn't there to judge. I was there to observe with Jonathan life on the Congo River, and that's what we observed.
So Jonathan, what did it taste like? Chicken?
I respectfully declined.
You didn't try it, huh? You were
no. It was just the camera that got close to that monkey, not my palate.
You weren't quite ready for that. Let me ask the both of you to describe in more detail for us about the people on the barge. How many people were there? And from your reports, I got the impression that it wasn't just a barge for transporting people from one place to another, but the barge had life of its own on the barge. Afabia?
I'll take the first answer. Yes, a life of its own, a rhythm of its own. We went quite slowly. People were quite frustrated on that barge. But we met everybody. We met a judo instructor who was trying to get to Kinshasa because he had to take his judo team. Was it to South Korea, Jonathan? Something like that.
I believe it was South Korea, exactly.
We had many, many traders, people who were trading in palm oil for cooking. We had people who were trading in all sorts. The boat was full. It was full of live animals. We had these head-butting goats who weren't very far from us on our place on the deck. I mean, there were lambs, there were chickens. Some were pets, but many were being taken down to the capital, Kinshasa, to be sold. So there was a lot of trade going on the boat. And of course, a lot of villagers coming in their dugout canoes, poling and paddling these canoes, sliding up against the barge, and then selling what we ate every day, plantains, cassava, fruit, the most delicious mangoes, papaya, and what else did we have, Jonathan? Oh, pineapples, I mean, fresh fish.
Yeah, if you remember, Ophabia, you cooked this, I will call it Ophabia's brew when I caught a bit of a cold. But all the material for that brew, the lemons and the honey, the only thing we brought tea, but everything that you could want for Ophabia's brew, which did make me feel better, by the way, was available from these dugout canoes that, as if on cue, at 7 in the morning, as we're steaming along down the Congo River, from the villages, these dugout canoes and people in them with all their goods just come straight for us, and haggling time begins. It's fascinating.
Let me ask you, Jonathan, because you are in Baghdad and the danger there is palpable. Did you have a sense of danger while you were on the barge going down the Congo River?
Well, you hear of barges in situations like these, not just in Central Africa, but other parts of Africa and other parts of the world that will overturn. So I was concerned about that, especially when you heard Ophabia's report. And there was at one point, you felt the barge kind of lunge downward. Like, okay, that's not good. And then our first night, we were introduced to the elements via a terrible rainstorm, which you don't want to be inside a boat like that with that type of rain. This is the first time I've been in a boat with rain, and the boat was really moving about. We were safe. There was one of two bad rainstorms, but we had a wonderful captain who said, I think, Ophabia, he could navigate the Congo River blindfolded or at night. They wouldn't let them go at night because for safety reasons, and the fact that when you go down the river, there's a big problem with sand barges, and that's what usually causes these barges to overturn. Matter of fact, I think after we finished our reports and we're putting them together, a barge did overturn and some people did lose their lives on the Congo River.
Well, you know, Ophabia, you mentioned also that there was a threat from Congolese rebels if you are on one of these barges, and security personnel have been added to make things safer. Before I ask you a question, let's listen to one more clip from your series.
Another daily ritual, security and immigration checkpoints, and even megaphone instructions. Security along the Congo River has been tightened in recent months because of unrest by rebels upriver. To comply with the new regulations means jumping into a dugout canoe and getting to shore to have travel documents checked. Most times it was just us the journalists singled out, but on a couple of occasions, all the passengers were ordered to leave the barge.
Now, Jonathan says that he was a little concerned about that boat, but my question for you, Ophabia, is whether or not there was more concern about the rebels and the potential for a rebel attack than the dangers of the barge itself.
You know, that's what we were told, Tony, and we were actually forbidden from going upriver because we had thought that maybe we'd go from Mbandaka up to Kisangani where the Stanley Falls are. We were told no because there had been some rebel activity. But, you know, once we were on the barge, I didn't feel at all unsafe and I didn't think any rebels were going to sneak up and suddenly try and abduct us. No, I was much, much more fascinated by the creativity, the ingenious creativity of the Congolese living on these barges or these lashed together barges, on this huge barge, 300 plus of us with all these animals and living as if they were almost living on land, except that we were on water. It was literally a floating supermarket, a floating market, a floating village. People were carrying on very organized, doing their cooking, doing their washing, using the river for everything, for cooking, for drinking, for bathing. The Congo River is second to none. It was absolutely extraordinary, Tony. And I advise everybody to take your courage, because it does need a little bit of courage,
to do it, huh?
And to travel down the Congo River. It was really an experience and discovery and adventure all the way.
Our time has run out. This has been a fascinating story to hear about. Jonathan Blakely, I'm going to give you the last word because I understand that as an African-American, which you are, that you were seen on the trip as something other than that. You know what I mean?
I do know what you mean, and I think that became quite apparent when I decided when we had one of our stops at one of the villages, I decided with among most people on the boat to take a bath in the Congo River. So me with my orange shorts and my two-toned sunburnt skin, I kind of stood out from everyone. And I was called by kids, Mundele, Mundele, Mundele. So it didn't take much to realize that they were calling me white man. But it's funny because that's just at that time, Ophabia, who was taking pictures, came by on a canoe and said, "You realize, is Obama black?" And they said, "Yeah, well, Jonathan's black too." And they were just dumbfounded. They had no idea what to say.
A remarkable story. Ophabia Quist-Arkton is NPR's West Africa correspondent, joining us from Dakar, Senegal. Jonathan Blakely is an NPR producer, joining us from Baghdad to hear their five-part series on the Congo River and see pictures from this remarkable trip. Just go to our website at npr.org. Ophabia, Jonathan, good job. Thank you very much.
Always a pleasure.
You're welcome.
I'm Tony Cox, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Michelle Martin is away. Coming up, we launch our education series with a look at free online tutorials. They're everywhere on everything. First, the death toll is at 28,000 and climbing in Mexico, killed directly or indirectly by the country's drug trafficking wars. One massacre last week left 72 migrants from South and Central America dead, and the investigator leading the probe into that massacre has gone missing. As well, the mayors of two Mexican cities, Santiago and Hidalgo, were assassinated. One bright spot for Mexican authorities, the arrest of La Barbie, whose real name is Edgar Valdez Villarreal. He is a U.S.-born former Texan who police say rose to the tops of one of Mexico's most powerful and brutal drug cartels. Joan Grillo, who contributes to Time magazine and other media outlets, is here with us to talk about La Barbie, the violence, and the cartels. He's in Managua, Nicaragua, working on a book about them. Also joining us is George Grayson. He authored a book called Mexico, Narco Violence and a Failed State? And he teaches government at the College of William and Mary. Welcome to both of you.
Thank you.
Joan, let me begin with you. There have been other arrests, but apparently none as significant as that of the man known as La Barbie. How significant do you see his arrest?
Well, it is significant in that he was a powerful player. He was involved with distributing tons of cocaine and other drugs to the United States. He was also a particularly violent player in this conflict. He's believed to be the person who first started the use of narco snuff videos in which he would kill rivals, often cutting their heads off or shooting them, film it and broadcasted that video on the internet. He was a very, very violent player, and to have him off the street is obviously a big hope for people. But the one problem that has confounded the Mexican government and one fundamental problem in this war is whenever you arrest one capo, one major drug trafficker, people simply fight to try and take their place.
Professor Grayson, Mexican President Felipe Calderon said that he was going to clamp down on drug violence, but things have taken a turn for the worse in Juarez and Cancun recently. Mexico City, even Acapulco, I believe, have seen drug-related violence. You're just back from Mexico. What is it like for citizens there? Is there no place that is safe, and is no one safe?
Tony, most of the country is safe. It just doesn't behoove you to go to, say, Ciudad Juarez, which is really a failed city, late at night, or certain areas of that particular municipality. There are areas such as the so-called Golden Triangle, where Chihuahua, Sinaloa, and Durango come together, which is a no-man's land. And there are no authorities, at least civil authorities, who can control that terrain.
Joan, the Associated Press reported that the Zetas cartel is one of the potentially most responsible for the recent killing of 58 men, 14 women, about 100 miles from the U.S.-Mexican border. Let me ask you why a drug cartel such as that would go after 72 migrants from Central and South America, where apparently most of the dead were from.
That massacre, which is indeed very, very sad, very tragic, 72 migrants, even one pregnant woman, and people not involved in drugs, people just traveling up to the United States to try and get jobs, to try and live the American dream. Now, that is, it really underlines one of the big problems in this whole conflict. The Zetas, as well as trafficking drugs, have used their power and the power they have by having so many armed men to extort and shake down everyone in their territory. Now, they've seen all these Central American migrants passing through the east of Mexico, where they're very strong. They've decided to try and shake them down over several years by doing these mass kidnappings. Now, you may think that poor migrants might not have that much money to give, but by holding these people, torturing them, phoning their families, and getting maybe $1,000 from each one, they've made tens of millions of dollars. And something along these lines was happening when it turned from a mass kidnapping into a massacre.
Professor Grayson, it's one thing for a cartel such as the Zetas to be involved in the crime that they have been involved with, but recently we saw the arrest of several Mexican police officers who were working both sides of the street. What can you tell us about the impact of that?
Tony, Mexico never in its history has had an honest police force. For 71 years, the PRI, the Institutional Revolutionary Party, governed Mexico in a rather authoritarian fashion. They created hundreds of police forces, but they also corrupted them because the law enforcement agencies were designed to advance the economic and political goals of the regime. And so it's not that Calderon is attempting to reform a police establishment that's gone bad. It's that he's starting from scratch to create police who have a terrible reputation in Mexico.
Now, one of the issues internationally is how the United States and Mexico both are dealing with this. Now, Congress and the president recently worked together to add $600 million to border security details. The question is whether or not that's going to help or hurt on both sides of the border, particularly, Professor Grayson, as it relates to this issue of violent crime.
Well, more and more Mexicans are trying to escape the dangerous situation, and they're attempting to make it across the border, and it's far more difficult. But if the violence continues, I think there will be a stampede to try to get into the United States, and that's going to lead us to use not only the Border Patrol and the National Guard, but perhaps even regular military units there.
Ewan, what do you think the U.S. will be able to do to affect the violence in Mexico?
I think the Obama administration haven't really got a key idea or strategy about how to deal with this. They inherited the deal from the Bush administration of pumping $1.3 billion into Mexico's kind of military institutions and police institutions to try and crack down on the drug violence. And they expanded that a bit, and then they give quite mixed signals. I mean, on one side, you see members of the administration saying there's a crisis, Mexico could be falling apart. Then you see other people, you know, you saw Hillary Clinton in her first visit to Mexico saying, no, there's no failed state in Mexico. This is like the crime wave that the U.S. had back in the 1980s and 1990s when it was roughing its cities. So I think they're really struggling to have a clear strategy or understanding of what is happening in Mexico.
Professor Grayson, I want to close the conversation with you. You made a point earlier about Mexico being safe unless you went to certain areas. Now, you know that in the resort town of Cancun just a few days ago, we had 8 people who were killed. True enough, they were not in the tourist area per se, about 5 miles away from it, as I understand it. Is it your view that Americans should feel safe traveling into Mexico?
I think you have to use common sense. And if you're going to a resort, don't delay your arrival, because the resorts have private security agencies, and the police are concerned about protecting resorts because they're so crucial in earning the foreign exchange that Mexico desperately needs.
Professor George Grayson joined us from member station WHRO in Williamsburg, Virginia. His latest book is called Mexico, Narco-Violence and a Failed State, ending with a question mark. He teaches government at the College of William and Mary. We also spoke with freelance journalist Ewan Grillo, who joined us from Nicaragua, where he is writing a book about Mexican drug cartels that will be published in 2011. Gentlemen, thank you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Throughout the month of September, Tell Me More will tell you more about issues in education. As kids head back to school, we'll bring you a series of conversations on what's outstanding, what needs improvement, and what gets an incomplete in the quest to strengthen the nation's schools and offer children from all backgrounds the best education possible. Today, one aspect of online education, video tutoring, and one man's quest to make it more accessible, more understandable, and free. Former hedge fund trader Salman Khan may be one of the most interesting voices for educating young and old alike in 2010. His work in the field started with attempts to help his seventh grade cousin learn math. He started taping his tutorials and then uploaded them to YouTube. Then, as some videos do, his tutorials went viral, spreading to millions, and Khan Academy was born.
I have 3 avocados. 1, 2, 3. And let's say you were to give me 4 more avocados. 1, 2, 3, 4. So how many total avocados do I have now? That's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 avocados.
Khan Academy doesn't give a degree, just perhaps, and this is its stated purpose, a better understanding of the topics at hand. Today, KhanAcademy.org has gotten more than 18 million page views from around the world, and Khan's original YouTube videos have gotten 10 times that. Salman Khan joins us from Stanford University. Sal, nice to have you on.
Great to be here.
So what is it that you were able to figure out that so many others have tried and not been nearly as successful as you?
I would guess you could call it a narrow focus on trying to
initially help just my cousins. And because of that, I was very student focused. I wasn't trying to go into the system and try to kind of massage what we all kind of understand as a fairly large system in some way. And I was just purely focused on how do I in the most efficient and quick way get that information into my cousins' heads. And then obviously those same videos could be used by more people. So there are things I think a lot of, about it a lot. They're fairly granular videos. They're in these 10-minute chunks, so it's very easy for people to jump in and jump out, get the concepts they need. The style is very conversational. I think if people go and experience the videos, they really feel like we're having a conversation, or that I'm next to the viewer going over problems with them, kind of like their tutor. You actually don't even see my face. It allows the students to focus more on the actual content.
Well, you know, you certainly have a very impressive curriculum vita with MBA from Harvard, 3 degrees from MIT, a BS in math, a BS and a master's in electrical engineering and computer science, president of your MIT class, volunteered at Brookline when you were living in Boston to teach children with ADHD. So with all of that kind of a background, what is it that you teach on your tutorials at Khan Academy?
I teach everything. As you'd mentioned earlier, I started off with literally 7th grade math because that's where my cousin Nadia was at. As more and more people who maybe weren't related to me started watching it and where the need was the most, I started doing pretty much all of math, starting with algebra and then going more advanced and more basic from there. If you look at the site now, it literally has, we have over 1,800 videos. There's literally a video on 1 + 1 = 2, but it goes all the way to sophomore, junior level mathematics. If someone's a math or a engineering major, linear algebra, differential equations, first year chemistry, college chemistry, or a high school, kind of an advanced high school chemistry. But the goal is that it's actually understandable by anyone. We have biology there. I'm actually kind of knee deep in organic chemistry right now. That's what I was doing earlier today. So it has a little bit of everything. There's actually 12 videos right now in world history that I hope to expand to eventually cover everything.
Now, one of the criticisms of what you do has nothing to do necessarily with the format. Well, actually, it does have something to do with the format. It's been called McNuggets teaching, where people aren't really getting as much substance as perhaps they need. The counter argument that I've read that you gave is that you're just trying to give the nugget of what is the topic.
I'll say a couple of things here. One is, I think the people who actually watch the videos find that they're actually much deeper and give much more intuition than what you would normally find in a classroom. And they don't try to teach people just the mechanics of things. They really go through great pains to show people a concept from multiple directions. The criticism of time length actually doesn't make much sense to me, just because, you know, right now we have 60 or 90 minute lectures, whether you're looking at, you know, K-12 or whether you're looking at a university. That 60 or 90 minute length was determined just by the logistics of getting people into a room. And obviously it wouldn't make sense to get people into a room and just do a 10 minute lecture and have them leave. But I think it would be hard to disagree with the idea that those 60 minute lectures could be divided into 6 10-minute lectures. And then each of those 10 minute lectures would be better because people don't need the entire 60 minute lecture. You could call my lectures McNuggets, but there are a lot of McNuggets. So the calculus videos, there's nearly 200 10-minute lectures on calculus. So it's not like I'm skipping things, or it's not like it's Cliff Notes. And I think what people find is actually there's more and deeper content on each concept than they would find in a textbook or a traditional lecture. My luxury is that I am not limited to the constraints of a traditional classroom where I have to manage a classroom or do other things with that time. If I want to spend 2 hours on a concept, I can. A traditional teacher might not be able to because of a curriculum or syllabus.
One of the other things that you are able to do, and we'll end the conversation with this, is you're able to offer this for free. You left a very lucrative Wall Street type job, and now you are doing this, but apparently you have been getting some help from some people with some very deep pockets. Is that right?
Right. No, when I started this, you know, the site had gotten enough traction and I was just excited about doing it and all of the feedback I'd gotten. I decided to quit my day job that you mentioned about a year ago, with the view that, you know, this is a highly scalable way to educate really millions of people. And one thing I always point out, it's not like a traditional school where if the funding goes away, or if, you know, God forbid I go away, that the education goes away, that this content never really goes old. And so even if I got hit by a bus, hope it doesn't happen, but if I did, these videos will keep teaching. So I figured that I'd be able to get some social capital invested, because our budget is actually very small. Right now it's
literally me. But it took about 9 months, and there are several people who've helped me out, really in a major way. You can imagine while you're digging into your savings, life isn't as stressless as you'd like it to be. And so Anne and John Doerr, who are fairly well known out here in Silicon Valley, were kind of the first. And very recently, Bill Gates has obviously become a fan.
Well, that doesn't hurt.
That doesn't hurt.
It doesn't hurt at all.
Doesn't hurt.
How far do you see this going?
My goal is to turn this into a free virtual school for the world where just on its own, anyone can go to the site. I'm going to keep making videos. We're going to translate them into all of the world's major languages. We want to cover literally everything. We're starting with science and math, but we want to cover everything. And we want to, in order to make it a real virtual school, it won't be just the instruction. That's what the videos are. It will also be kind of adaptive exercises, a community where people can learn and teach from each other. So it could just stand on its own as a place for people to learn that I hope eventually can actually become, you can almost imagine the DNA or the operating system for the future physical experience, a kind of a hybrid school that uses things like, or preferably the Khan Academy itself, to kind of handle the core skills, the core lectures, the core exercises, and it frees up both teachers and students' times to kind of, you know, paint pictures and build robots, whatever else they want to do.
Salman Khan is founder and instructor of KhanAcademy.org. He is also a recipient of the Microsoft Tech Award for Education. He joined us from Stanford, California. Sal, thank you very much.
Thank you.
And that's the program for today. Tell Me More is produced by Jamila Bay, Bracton Booker, Luis Clemens, Jasmine Garzd, Lee Hill, Douglas Hopper, Arjun Hutchins, Zishan Jiwani, Veronica Miller, Emily Oxenschlager, Rob Sachs, Amy Ta, and Chinime Wilson. Our line editor is Kyle McKinnon. Our senior supervising editor is Portia Robertson-Migas. Our senior producer is Alicia Montgomery. The program is directed by Monica Estatieva. Our technical director is Kimberly Jones. Our theme music was composed by Underdog Entertainment with additional arrangements by Ian Honeyman. The supervising senior producer is Tashima Walker. I'm Tony Cox. You have been listening to Tell Me More from NPR News and the African American Public Radio Consortium. We'll talk more tomorrow.